You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
Belted to left field. Billy comes through tonight. Splash!
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
And welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault. We're here with you for another glorious show. And as you, if you listened to the show last week, you heard Troy Olson is going to kind of taking a step back this summer. So you've got me, I'm your host, and it's going to be like that for a while. So here I am, Jeff Herr again, as always. And with me, of course, the effervescent Mike, how you doing tonight?
I'm pretty good. My shoulder's a little sore. I was throwing batting practice tonight. So
batting practice to the little ones, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, I was doing my best Bruce impersonation.
What age group do you coach again?
14 and under.
Nice. So maybe kind of just to the point where they're getting a little competitive.
Yeah, and it's a pretty competitive league too. It's to the point now where in Lawrence, the youth leagues, really they only do competitive leagues anymore because they never have enough players to do rec leagues.
Huh.
So I mean, I guess in the end, you're kind of using the same talent pool. But, I mean, the good teams are really good.
Yeah,
and the bad teams, I don't know. We haven't played our first game yet, so we'll see.
Fair enough.
We had a scrimmage. We got one walk, and that was it.
Hey, you know, it's spring training for the little leaguers too, right?
Even though yeah.
It's the season, but we're okay. So anyway,
you don't want me to coach you.
What's that?
What'd you don't say? Want me to coach your little league
team. Oh, okay. I gotcha. Yeah. I'll be sure to get a list before I have a little league team, and I'll make sure to put you a little bit down the ways. It'll be my last resort. How's that sound?
That's probably smart.
All right. Well, let's talk about some Major League Baseball now. We got the Kansas City Royals, of course, going. It was DEFCON 4. All is lost. 4-7. Just got swept by the awful, awful Twins. And things were looking bad. And they kind of salvaged things. The last six games, they've gone 5-1. They ended up going, you know, after starting a nine-game stretch, going 0-3, they ended up going 5-4. So that was pretty good because they had Minnesota, Houston, and then Minnesota again. So you thought, well, if they're going to make some damage, they could do that. You know, if they went 6-3, that'd be pretty good. They could, that would give them a little breathing room maybe, and didn't start off well, but they came back. They swept the Astros. They came back, took two of three from the Twins. Last night, we're doing this on Monday, April 21st. So last night, Sunday, was when Easter, Yordano Ventura pitched and got roughed up a little bit, probably his worst outing as a pro so far. I don't know if I say that. I know he had one kind of rough outing last year, so I'd have to go back and really compare the two. But his worst outing this year, for sure. And you know, we knew it was going to happen. He wasn't going to win every game. It was just a question of when. And now the remaining question of how's he going to come back from this? The things that I take from it, the solace from that, is looking at his minor league progression. Basically, every time he took a next step, he kind of stumbled a little bit. When he went to high A, he did. When he went to double A, he did. When he went to triple A, he did. And every time he came back, it was because for whatever reason, he seemed to be kind of a mid-year guy where he would get kicked up to that next level and mid or near the end of the year. And then he would start the next year at the same level and ended up each time came back more than ready than he was before and usually kind of dominated. So I really look for him to bounce back from this because I think it's in his nature. He doesn't seem like a guy who really gets in his own head and puts too much pressure on himself or anything like that. So I think he's going to be fine. But, I mean, overall, I think you got to be happy with considering starting from the point where they went 0-3 on that little stretch and they were 4-7. I think you got to be happy with where they are. I mean, how do you feel about that little nine-game stretch there, Mike?
Well, I mean, a week ago or a week and a day ago, we were pretty much everybody's ready to pack it up after 11 games because the Royals were, you know, 4-7 and really didn't look like they were going to do you know, they just look really bad in Minnesota. And they, you know, the thing about it, when you get to play Houston, you start to look a lot better. And the Royals, and, you know, they got some good pitching out of, you know, Ventura, and James Shields had a really good down there. And it just kind of worked out. They had a nice late rally in Jeremy Guthrie's start and ended up winning that in extras. And Duffy looked great out of the bullpen in that game. And so, you know, they were able to take that and get a three-game sweep and ride the momentum, and then, you know, came back home to Minnesota and, you know, really had, you know, that first game of the Minnesota series at home was pretty much solid. I mean, it looked great again. Moustakas hit a homer. Everybody looked good. Gordon, a couple of great plays. And really, only one twin hit the ball all that hard, and he was thrown out at second trying to get a double. So, you know, that was a good one. They won the next game. And then, yeah, I mean, Ventura just – he didn't look sharp. Didn't look like any of his pitches were really under command very well. But it's – you know, in the end, he only – I mean, only. He only gave up 4 earned runs in 4 innings. So it's not like he got completely blown out of the water or anything. He limited the damage about as well as he could have, considering that, you know, he walked 4 and gave up 6 hits. You know, he didn't give up a homer. You know, he just kind of happened to, you know, he was a little wild. He wasn't very sharp. And it was against Minnesota, who is right now the most patient team in the majors. I mean, they seem to be walking, you know, 5-6 times a game, it seems. So I'm not too worried about it. He still struck out 6, and he looked a lot better after the first inning yesterday. And so, you know, it seemed like he rebounded a little bit better. But, you know, they're not going to win them all. It'd be nice if they could.
Of course.
They're not, you know, so.
And I think to that point, you know, I think he could have settled in and maybe gone a little bit longer, since he was kind of limiting the damage. I didn't see the game, but just from what I could follow on Twitter and everything and see how it was going, it probably seems like he might have been able to stick it out for another inning or two and try and keep things going. But, you know, for better or for worse, Ned Yost is the kind of manager that he likes to protect his players. And when, especially when you have a young guy like that, I think he would often err on the side of pulling him versus letting him try to ride it out to save him a little bit, and then kind of just get some bullpen pitchers in there and do a little mop-up duty. Whereas if it was, you know, if it was James Shields in that scenario, he might have left him out there. I don't
He did when Shields was in Minnesota. He just let him kind of grind it.
Yeah, and sometimes
you just kind of had to wear it, basically.
Yeah, and sometimes you need that. I mean, I remember last year there was a game where I think it was Shields pitching against Alex Cobb for the Rays, and the Royals ended up winning 8-0. But Cobb pitched a complete game and gave up those 8 runs. So that's still valuable. You know, sometimes it's just good to go. You get through it, you take your lumps and, you know, save the bullpen, whoever, you know, because it was, I think James Shields pitched a complete game as well. So that was one of the things where the next day both bullpens were just completely available. So yeah, sometimes it's good to just go that to just get out there and, you know, finish what you started more or less. But if Yordano Ventura was a little bit older, they might have. But yeah, to echo your sentiment, I don't know that I'm worried either.
If he does again the next time out, then you start to kind of worry a little.
Yeah, yeah. And it sometimes, I mean, they're depending on who the player is. Ventura is pretty under control out there, but sometimes you can kind of tell too when a player's pressing or when he starts to get to him that he starts realizing that things are getting difficult. And you kind of saw it sometimes with Danny Duffy. You can see it with Moustakas at the plate. You could see it with Hosmer when things don't go right for him. So you can kind of see it's a hopeful when you start to see that and their stuff's not working, then you would worry about Ventura, but we're not to that point yet. So we won't talk about it, but a couple of the things that you hit on that will, talked about Danny Duffy having a great session out of the bullpen. He's had a couple, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the show. Something of note, you mentioned Mike Moustakas had a home run, and we forgot to press our special button that had the balloon on the ceiling with the confetti. Mike Moustakas, 2 games in a row, didn't he, had a home run? Or he's had?
I think it was 2 out of 3.
2 out of 3, okay. I knew they were close.
Still, I mean,
he's had 2 home runs now, leads the team.
Leads the team.
Still batting less than 200, but looks like sure. Might be coming out of his just horrible, horrible funk a little bit, to the point where he might just be. The last, say, 6 to 10 games, he's probably been just an average major league hitter, which is what they need him to be. But it was the, you know, however many games before that, the 8 to 10 games before that, where he didn't have a hit. So, but good to see him kind of break out of his shell a little bit. But first, to lead off, we're going to talk about not only Mike Moustakas' struggles, but the whole team's struggles offensively. They've had a little bit of a, this past weekend, as Mike kind of mentioned, especially against the Twins, they had a little bit of a, and against the Astros, a little bit of a resurgence on the offense and kind of showed that they can produce some runs, but they've still gotten a lot of help from other teams. There's been a lot of, seems like they've really caught a lot of bad defense that they're playing up against. I mean, they had an, even tonight, as we record this show, they had an unearned run that scored. So it seems like just from glancing at stuff, they've had a lot of unearned runs that have scored, but maybe that's just perception versus actual reality. I haven't looked it up quite yet, but the big thing that everyone's talking about that is a legitimate concern is the ground ball rate for this team, Mike. I don't know what these guys are doing because I am not a hitting coach nor a scout. There is something that they are doing that is not working well for them because they're grounding. I mean, I should try and pull this up really quick while we're talking, but the amount of double play is just, it seems like it's just unbelievable. Every time they get up and there's a man on, it's almost like clockwork. If there's a man on first, it's going to be a double play. And it's not Billy Butler. I mean, it is, but it's not just Billy Butler. Sal Perez has problems with it. He leads the team. Eric Hosmer is having problems with it. I think they both have more than Butler in double plays. Yep. And
they both have four.
What's that?
They both have four double plays.
Yeah, and Butler has three, I think. So, I mean, they've played, what are they? They're 9-8 right now, not counting tonight's game. So it's roughly a tenth of the way through the season. I mean, right now they're on pace to have 40 apiece for Sal Perez and Hosmer. That's gonna lead the league if they both have 40. So I mean, that is a problem. And when you look at the ground ball rates for this team, I mean, for the everyday players, Jerod Dyson is not quite an everyday player, even though he's been kind of thrust into that role recently. But starting with Billy Butler, he's at 64.7% on the ground ball rate, and that is awful. Now, to say something for him, a week ago this time, he was at 73%. And
yeah,
his ground ball rate, or I'm sorry, his line drive rate was somewhere at like 12, and now I think he's at 17.6%. So he's kind of climbing up there. But then you go to Nori Aoki, 64.7%, Hosmer, 59.3%. Perez is at 45. That's starting to get a little bit more normalized there. I'm not Mike, do you know what the league average is off the top of your head?
I don't know off the top of my head, but you generally, I think you want to be around 18-19 on line drive fly balls. You kind of want it to split up from there, so probably about 40-ish.
Yeah, that's what I was
thinking. That is a guess, so you know, nobody should take that as a full head in front of me.
And the line drive rates, like you said, 18-19% is where you want to be. 20, you're looking pretty good. Not a single everyday player for the Royals has a 20% line drive rate. And while at the end of the year, if you say that, that's not necessarily anything that's a huge deal. But right now, with the small sample sizes we have, you'd think somebody would be there. But Aoki is leading the team for everyday players with a 19.6%. I mean, when you look at all these, or I'm sorry, Escobar, I'm sorry, has a 22.77%, and then Infante is 20. Okay, so I'm sorry, I misspoke. I missed them on the list here. So Escobar and Infante both have above 20%. So there is that. And Escobar is actually having what looks to be almost like a 2012 repeat. So we can only
hope. Escobar's the best player on the team right now.
No, but I mean, what worries you about this trend you're seeing, Mike? You're a little bit more of a scouting eye than I am. I mean, is there anything that you see from these players that worries you?
Well, I mean, Butler really started out, he was really slow getting his bat through. So even if it's a hittable pitch, you know, he was hitting everything onto the ground. And with him, he's not gonna leg that out. You know, he's just not. I mean, we know Billy Butler's not a fast guy. It doesn't need to be, you know, pounded into the ground. But that's all he was doing. And he had like a 7-to-1 ground ball to fly ball ratio, and you know, nothing was being lofted. He wasn't really hitting anything very hard. It's only over the last few days where he's actually hit the ball with any kind of authority and, you know, finally got a double. You know, his first double of the year came, you know, 15, 16 games in. So, you know, that's troubling for sure. And he's always been a guy who's been above 50% on his ground ball rate. You know, that's just how it is. Hosmer has looked off balance in a lot of cases. He's missed a lot of hittable pitches. And, you know, for a guy like him, you know, he's got to be hitting for more power too. Even if it's just doubles, he's got a few, and when he connects, he really nails it. But you know, he's little choppers and things like that are trying to pull an outside pitch. And I think just glancing at the box score, I think both Perez and Hosmer grounded into another double play each tonight. So that's a problem. Perez, you know, he started out really hot, but he's, like 4 for his last 40. So he hasn't walked over that stretch either. You know, the big story, you know, the first week and a half was, he's walking all the time. He had 8 walks and the next closest Royal had 5. And, you know, now it's evened out a lot more because, you know, they haven't been pitching around him and he's helped him out. So that's a problem too. And so when you get these guys where, you know, Moustakas hasn't been hitting, Butler hasn't been hitting, Aoki has been inconsistent. He's been hitting well at home, not so much on the road. I don't know why. Moustakas, it took him like 2 weeks to hit his first line drive. And even though he's swinging the bat a little better, you know, he's still the thing where he pops it up on the infield doing, you know, the thing where he's hitting it into the shift and things like that. And so, you know, you're having trouble getting guys on in the first place, like the Royals are prone to do, because they're not a patient organization from a hitting standpoint. They're not going to walk that often. So when you do get those base runners on, you want to take advantage of the Royals have been grounded into double plays. And so, you know, you're just killing any momentum you could get in an inning that way. Early on, they weren't hitting with runners in scoring position. Just a lot of problems all at once. And no power. Nobody's, you know, got 6 total home runs as a team. And some of that you could really say Alex Gordon's first homer was, you know, by Hit Tracker Online, it was pretty much a lucky homer. If you look at what they did in Houston, I mean, that I'm pretty sure I could knock one out, you know, with the right pitch in Houston if the roof's open, because it's a playground. I mean,
or one of your kids could if you were pitching to him.
Yeah, probably. Maybe one of the kids. Not all of them. But yeah, in Houston's not really a good gauge of, you know, home run hitting, because it's a bandbox. It's so tiny. And so, you know, I think Moustakas, he got a hold of a good one on Friday, and Escobar had a good one yesterday. And, you know, the others, you kind of have to question how they got out, because, you know, it's either stadium or, you know, circumstance that kind of really helped them out. And so that makes it difficult to score runs too. I mean, you can call home runs rally killers, but in a lot of cases, you know, that 3 runs is a pretty good rally. You know, you get a home run, it doesn't really matter if you keep it going, because you got your runs. They're in there.
And let's segue this into kind of a power discussion here, because I have grown so tired of hearing the Royals constantly make excuse after excuse about why you cannot hit home runs in Kauffman Stadium. And I know that Kauffman Stadium is one of the bigger parks in all of Major League Baseball, and it is more difficult. But the fact that Joe Posnanski, the reason it's a little bit fresher in my mind to bring this up is because Joe Posnanski actually wrote an article about this that I saw today, or a blog, I should say, on his blog site, about how the Royals have by the lowest team record home run total of any team in the major leagues, which we all knew. It's 36 for obviously the great Steve Balboni from 1985. And the closest is the Mets with 41, and there was another team, I can't remember who, at 41. And then it just kind of escalates from there, obviously, until you get to San Francisco's 73 for Barry Bonds. So, I mean, I kind of looked at – I didn't go full bore and really look a ton into it, but I looked at some players like a Jermaine Dye and Carlos Beltran and some of the more power hitters that have come through in the last 15 years or so. And that was because that was an interesting point that Posnanski brought up, is that the majority of the records, the team records in home runs, have happened the last 15 years. Since that kind of 1998, that the peak of the steroid era, if you will, all the way into, you know, even some just last year. But so I looked, and it's not like, you know, Carlos Beltran, I think, had 2 years where he actually is the Mets record holder at 41, which is kind of funny. But I think he had 2 years where he hit over 36, and then Jermaine Dye had, I think he also had two after leaving Kansas City where he hit over 36. But if you look at a lot of those guys, it's not as though they're, you know, just racking up power numbers everywhere else. So as in, you know, hitting, it's not like, okay, once Carlos Beltran left Kauffman Stadium, he's popping 50, 55 home runs, you know? So my question, where do you come out on this, Mike? Do you think that it truly is Kauffman? Is that prohibitive? Because I'm definitely agreeing that there is a home run suppression in Kauffman. But do you think it's that prohibitive, or do you think it is the organization's lack of getting players in that can hit home runs and making that a focus of the organization? I mean, where do you come out on this whole thing?
Well, I could see that there's an approach thing to it because, you know, even if you look at what they, you know, last year when Jack Maloof and everybody was really scuffling, you know, he came out and he was like, we're not going to try to hit home runs. And okay, that's, I guess you don't have to try, but you know, there is a certain point where you have players who have talent to just even just run into one, you know, guys who just make contact and just put it out. And, you know, you look at guys like Moustakas was supposed to be, you know, 35, 40 home run type of guy. And Hosmer was a 30 home run type of guy. And, you know, to look at him, you can even see, you know, you can see glimpses every now and then. Butler hit 29 1 year. But it does seem like the Royals never have those guys. And I know that Kauffman's going to have an effect. I mean, it would be naive to say that it didn't. But, you know, you still don't see these guys hitting, you know, they're not hitting like 24 homers when they're on the road. So it's not like, you know, they get out of Kauffman and start doing that and then they only finish with, you know, 29 or something. You know, the last guy to hit 30 was Dean Palmer right. in 99, or was it Jermaine Dye?
Jermaine Dye in 2000.
Yeah. So, I mean, even in that whole stretch, and that's the money spot. I mean, that's where guys like Tony Bautista was hitting, you know, 40 and, you know, guys who you couldn't even pick out of a lineup anymore are you know, hitting 30, 40 homers just out of nowhere. And the Royals never got in any of that, you know, at all. I mean, there was a year where Unieski Betancourt led the team in home runs, and that's just not something that can happen. And so, you know, now this is really the group where you would expect that to kind of turn around because Hosmer, you know, you look at him, he's prototypical big slugger guy. I mean, look at him, compare him to Freddie Freeman. They look like the same type of player. And Freeman's a guy who can do that, but Hosmer isn't. And, you know, I don't know if that's something with how he's getting coached or anything like that. He does seem to run into periods where, you know, like right now, he's really just off balance. He's, you know, can't ever decide if he wants to do, you know, a full stride or if he just wants to kind of lift his foot and get his momentum going. So that's one of those things. And Moustakas, you know, he's always been a pop-out guy. I don't know if he's ever going to do it. And even Butler with his 29, the only other professional year where he had hit more than 20 homers in a season was rookie ball when he was in High Desert. And High Desert is, you know, right in the middle of Arizona, and it's a small park, and it's, you know, notorious for home runs. So, you know, a lot of these guys, you expect them to be bigger power hitters just looking at them, but there's something that, you know, even outside of Kauffman prevents them from hitting home runs, other than, you know, Will Myers, but of course they don't have him anymore. So,
right.
It always seems like, and I run into this with like all my sports teams. It just seems like, You ever like watch a team and you know it's a big spot and they just go and do it. We need a big out here and they just go do it.
Yeah.
And the Royals get in that same spot and they just you know half the time they crap all over themselves.
Yeah.
Or you know okay you know watching basketball and okay we need a 3-pointer and you know one team will just go do it and you know KU will you know throw it away or something. It's just like. It's you know, those are selective times, but it seems like that happens all the time for the Royals where, you know, they just don't have guys who go and do it. Yeah. And it's, I don't know. I don't know if it's systematic. It seems like it should be because, it's been such a long-term problem, and even guys who are highly touted are coming through and still having the same struggles. So it seems like it's a little bit of Kauffman and a little bit of approach and development.
Well, because if you look at Jermaine Dye, right, he was not he was not developed by the Royals. He was developed mostly by the Braves and then traded really early in his career to the Royals. Well, he has, in his career, he hit 33 for the Royals in 2000, the last Royal to hit 30, and he hit 44 for the White Sox in 06, and that's the only other time that he hit more than 36, so he only had one season. And then I pulled up Carlos Beltran's stats. He hit 41 in 2006 for the Mets, and that's the only other time that, he hit in 2004, the year that he got, or 2004, the year that he got traded, he hit 38. So I don't have that broken out to see how many are with team. And then another guy that's made some decent power numbers, Raul Ibanez. You know, he, again, wasn't developed by the Royals, but they had him for a few years. And, I mean, he's never hit more than 36 home runs, even with some of the solid power numbers that he's had in his career. So to me, I'm tired of hearing about it. I'm tired of hearing the excuse, because there are comparable ballparks. I looked it up the other day, and I need to do this. There are comparable ballparks around Major League Baseball, and all of them have produced a 40 home run hitter. And it brings up the question of, are the Royals an organization that, and Posnanski kind of touched on this a little bit in his article, where he says that back in the day, the Royals had the AstroTurf, they had the big park, they had the quick, fast guys that could get the ball into the gaps, and they could make hay on the bases. And that was their image. That's what they did. And then the decline started when those people started getting older. They started getting slower. They couldn't hit as well. You know, the George Bretts of the world, the Willie Wilsons that just didn't quite have it like they used to. And then it's almost like those players and that era moved on, but the Royals never did. You know, and so it seems almost like up until the last few years, maybe, it's almost like they've been developing and drafting and acquiring players to that same mold, even though it's not really working. I mean, yeah, they've had some guys that have been touted as big power guys, and Bob Hamlin, and he had a decent, you know, rookie year and won rookie of the year. So he had a pretty good rookie year, actually. And then, he flames out, and you've got all these guys, and it's just, you know, what's the deal? And I personally don't buy it that it's the park. I think there's a developmental something that is going into this, whether it's the players they acquire or how they teach them to hit at a young age or how they teach them to go. I mean, that's just, you know, anecdotally and from what I see and what I've just lived through, I just don't believe that there's no player. I mean, basically what the Royals want you to believe is that nobody in Major League Baseball can hit 40 or more home runs, or 30, more than 36 home runs in Kauffman Stadium. That's what they want you to believe. And the Royals, just like anything else, think that you're stupid enough to believe it, to be honest with you. But, I mean, like, take Ryan Howard, for example. What did he have in 2006? Like 58 home runs or whatever it was? I mean, do you honestly think that someone like Ryan Howard hits 58 home runs in a year? You don't think that they'll hit 37 in Kauffman? You know, I mean, I need to go look at his spray chart from that year and see where runs landed and count how many would be home runs in Kauffman Stadium, because that's just ludicrous to me. You know, where are the Royals' Ryan Howards? You know, they could have drafted him. He was like a fifth round pick or something, and he was in freaking Springfield playing baseball for SMS at the time, which is now Missouri State. And the Royals, I mean, there's no way they didn't know about him, but they didn't pick him for a reason. And, you know, I mean, now it doesn't look so bad, because all he does is strike out 40% of the time. But there was a stretch of 3 or 4 years where he was one of the most feared hitters in baseball. And
they could use the homers.
Yeah, and help Phillies win a World Series. So, you know, to me, I just don't buy the park thing. So I don't know. I mean, I can.
Well, if I present the counterpoint to that, though, I mean, if you're looking at it from since 1985, And that's the last time they had, you know, 36 homer. That's when the record was set. Even through different general managers, different personnel on the field, the one constant has been the stadium. And so I think that it does play into it. I don't think it's all the stadium. I don't think you can just say, okay, it's because of the stadium, and so we're not going to try.
Right.
I do think it is the personnel right now, for the most part, but there is, you know, going to be, you know, the stadium's going to be a problem.
I certainly think there's a suppression element. So to stay with the Ryan Howard example, he hits 58 in Philadelphia, and I don't think that doesn't translate to 58 at Kauffman. So I can live with that. You know, I can live with someone not hitting 58 home runs, but this idea that the Royals are trying to con me into believe that 36 home runs is just some epic feat, that it takes just a titan of baseball power to eclipse the number, like, it's BS. I'm not buying it. And I don't know. Here's
the counterpoint to my previous counterpoint. Last year, the Royals hit 112 home runs. 57 were on the road, 55 at home. So pretty much exactly the same in both spots. So, I mean, a 410-foot hit is a 410-foot hit. You know, that's going to clear the fence in most places. If you don't have guys who can hit it that far, you're not going to hit, you know, you're not going to hit a lot of home runs. And, you know, there is, you know, to an extent, I mean, they had guys like Escobar and Chris Getz, and, you know, they're really high on Jerod Dyson all the time. And, you know, just all those different guys who are not going to be home run hitters. And, you know, David DeJesus was not a home run hitter. Mark Tian wasn't really a home run hitter. And those were guys that they identified as, you know, key parts of their lineup at different points. You know, everyday players, you know, number two hitters, things like that. And so, you know, those are choices that they're making, and they're choosing them over other guys who might have more power. You know, a guy like Aaron Hill, you know, they had an opportunity to acquire him. Maybe they don't value him as much because there's this or that flaw and he doesn't fit, you know, the Getz mold of defense and speed and doing all the little things. But he'd hit some runs, and, you know, maybe he has these deficiencies, but he doesn't do these things that they want them to do. And Jason Kendall, a few years ago, when he was, you know, the catcher, and they signed him to, you know, a couple year deal, and, you know, he hadn't had any power over the last few years of his career, and, you know, they played him, you know, 150 games and batted him second all the time. So, you know, there's definitely some personnel choices that they're making as well that, you know, are going to factor into that. And, you know, having the stadium doesn't help either.
Right. And, okay. I mean, I found a quick spray chart here and tried to pull it up, and it's hard to tell now. I'll have to dig into this a little bit more. But I mean, there are, it's hard to tell from this one because it's, I don't know if this is stadium specific. I think this is just everywhere, but yeah, there's gotta be, it's like you said, 410-foot home run is 400. So if they're going to hit it out in Kauffman, they're going to hit it out anywhere. And if Kauffman's so big and you get people that, you know, maybe quote-unquote have warning track power or whatever, well, then they should be blasting home runs all over the place. If they're hitting them to the warning track consistently in Kauffman, and Kauffman's so huge, then, you know, where are all these home runs on the road? You know, if you hit 25 home runs on the road and you hit 15 in Kauffman, then that's a pretty big gap, but that's 40 home runs, you know? So, I mean, there you go. That's a new team record. Boom, right there. The Royals no longer have one of the most dubious records in all sports. It's just that simple. But I don't know. We kind of got off on a tangent there, but Poznanski wrote the article. Did you read that, by the way, Mike? It's pretty interesting. I don't know if you read that, but
I did not yet. I have it favorited so I can go find it later.
You should read it. It's kind of interesting. He doesn't really, Poznanski doesn't give his opinion on where he comes out, on whether it's the park, whether it's the Royals or whatever. I think it was just one of those things where you wake up and you're like, crap, the Royals record is still 36 home runs. I gotta write something about this because I'm defeated for yet another day. But on that note, we're going to take a break. And when we get back, Mike and I are going to tell you all why, despite what some people may try and tell you, James Shields is not an ace in Major League Baseball. So we will discuss that when we get back on the other side. We'll be right back.
Come to Spit Cup this week. We'll let the person who has the highest bar tab ride the bull. We don't have any TVs in our bar, but we make our own entertainment. Mondays, it's free cover charge to anybody with a gun rack in their pickup truck. Tuesdays, we've got $8 beer night. All domestic beers are on special for only $8. It's Spit Cup. Wednesdays is longest tobacco spit. Thursdays is foot fungus night. Friday night is jamboree night. Bring your crap kick in your 10-gallon hats. And this weekend, you get our world-famous Spit Cup girls. You get to pick which one has the most teeth. It's Spit Cup. No love letters, talking to the wall.
Or you could go to Kelly's Westport Inn. The highest quality drinks with the lowest prices. You know what we do. Drinks, friends, plenty of TV showing sports. They've got all the basketball and all the baseball on. Live music on the weekends. The best pizza in Kansas City and fun. Kelly's has the best rooftop patio in town and is voted one of the best places in Kansas City to check out the view, if you know what I mean, and maybe make a new friend. Make the best choice for your evening entertainment, Kelly's Westport Inn. Kelly's is at 500 Westport Road in Kansas City, Missouri. Kelly's Westport Inn. Tell them the Royal Man Report sent you. Somebody stands up and says you're sick of the controlling and the silver spoon that feeds all your stories and your bowling. Are you listening? Are you listening? And welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault. I am your host, Jeff Herr, and with me, as always, is Michael Engel. We just talked about the Royals and their offensive woes and whether or not the Royals are trying to get you to believe a load of BS when they say that it's hard to hit home runs in Kauffman Stadium. I think yes, Mike's not quite convinced, but he does recognize that there is a little bit of a disconnect there. So as we go from that, we'll move into now the pitching side of things, where we told you we were going to tell you why James Shields is not an ace. So this is the thing. James Shields just... Let's remove the fact that Will Myers won Rookie of the Year last year, if we can. It's hard for some people, myself included, but let's try and remove that for a second and just look at James Shields. Forget about what they gave up to acquire him. What is James Shields as value to the Royals? And it is innumerably high. He is a stabilizing force in the pitching staff. He is a frontline pitcher for sure. He is just, he's consistent. He's good. You know what you're going to get. Even when he's bad, he can still – we kind of hit on it a little bit at the beginning. When he's bad, you can still grind it out. He can still move through. He might give up four runs, but he's still going to go six innings. You know, so he can pitch that complete game. Just he has been – he's worth an acquisition. If you want to talk what value they gave up, you know, that's a different topic. We've talked about that ad nauseum. It's not a topic anymore, but – he is worth acquiring because he's a difference maker. Now, the question is James Shields an ace? You hear people on the radio talking, oh, he's an ace. People on Twitter go nuts, you know, oh, he's an ace and all that stuff. And personally, and I think Mike's with me on this, I do not think James Shields is an ace. And Mike, well, before I get into my reasoning, let's get your take on this. What do you think?
Well, it's important to preface that when we say James Shields is not an ace, that's not saying that James Shields is a bad pitcher. It's like you said, he's a very good acquisition. He's got great value. And I think also if you asked 20 different people what an ace in Major League Baseball is, you're going to probably get 20 different definitions on that. So it's a very, it's one of those nebulous terms that does not have a real definition. Nobody's really come out to define it as, you know, X amount of performance by whatever metric you want to measure. And that's why I think it comes up as a discussion topic so much. With James Shields, you know, he's one of my favorite pitchers. I mean, he's always been one of my favorite pitchers since, 2008. He's, you know, he throws a lot of innings. He gets a lot of strikeouts. He doesn't walk a lot of guys. I mean, that's an extremely valuable pitcher. You know, he does everything you want a guy to do, even if you take out the intangible side of things, which, you know, depending on how much you measure those, you know, he adds that as well. But for me, even though I'm generally going to be looking at stats when I'm trying to compare people in a lot of cases, the ace question comes down to a little bit of I know it when I see it. And there's kind of, it's almost a gut reaction. And for me, if I have to ask myself, is that guy an ace? That answers my question right there. And so to me, there's a very small number of aces. I think there are a larger number of frontline pitchers of which aces are a subgroup. But I don't think that just saying he's a frontline guy says he's an ace. And that's how I define it. And I wouldn't put him in that 1A group. He could be 1B or that second tier, but he's just not quite in there despite every positive that you mentioned.
Okay, Mike, so let's try a little exercise to kind of piggyback off that point of you know it when you see it. I've got a list pulled up here of the top pitchers in the league last year from 2013. So looking at a full season through their WAR numbers. Now this is from FanGraphs, so there's probably going to be a little bit of a difference between this and Baseball Reference, but it's all relative. So I'm going to throw out some names, and I'm going to tell you. I want you to tell me if you take them over James Shields. We're talking seventh game of the World Series, full rest, one pitcher to win the game, championship for your team. Are you picking X or are you picking James Shields? All right, let's start with Clayton Kershaw, the $30 million man. Who are you going to pick?
That one's pretty obvious. Kershaw is probably the best pitcher in baseball right now, so I'm going to go with Kershaw.
Okay. Max Scherzer.
Scherzer's pretty close. Some of his track record might not be the same. He's been very good recently. That one I almost have to say a toss-up, so I think on that one I might go Shields.
Okay. That's fair, because big game James is a little bit of the experience there. But I mean, Scherzer's been to the playoffs. But what hurts him, I think, is his age. He's so young. He doesn't have the trick. Not so young, but young that he doesn't have the track record that Shields does. So that's what I think hurts him. But okay.
Yeah, and there's always a chance for like a regression, or you know, there's always some pitchers that will have six really good years and then they start to fall off pretty quickly. And not to say that Scherzer will be one of those, but you know, it's something, you know, when Shields, who's been pitching, you know, for
eight, nine years.
I mean, you kind of know what you're going to get out of them, and it's generally pretty consistent.
Yeah. Okay. Keeping going. Anibal Sanchez.
Not an ace. Like, I would put him kind of in the same area as Shields. Last year, if they would have somehow acquired Sanchez, I would say Shields and Sanchez would have been the rotation order for me.
Okay. Adam Wainwright.
Wainwright's pretty darn good. I'd go Wainwright.
Okay.
On that.
Matt Harvey.
Big game performances. Matt Harvey is tough. If you take away the injury, younger guy, you look at his stuff, he's pretty darn good. He's always had a good scouting profile. I would have to hold off on Harvey for right now.
Okay.
I'll say Shields.
Okay, so we had that was just the top five right there in FanGraphs and WAR. And we'll keep going, throw out a few other names. But just to recap so far, only two pitchers that you would take over James Shields from the top five. So just based on
and
that.
On gut reaction, I mean, yeah, that's pretty solid.
Yeah. So keeping going, then Felix Hernandez.
I mean, I think Hernandez is one of those guys that's an easy slam dunk example of this guy is an ace.
Yep. Justin Verlander.
Verlander. Same thing. He's probably he and Kershaw would probably be the best examples for that.
Okay.
Even Hernandez, I would put a little notch below those two.
Cliff Lee.
I would say Cliff Lee. had a rough year last year, but he rebounded pretty well too. Or at least it was rough early, I believe. But Cliff Lee, I mean, he's been elite for years. And, you know, another big innings guy. So I would...
Definitely Cliff Lee of 3 years ago and probably even still Cliff Lee now.
Yeah, I would lean just barely over Shields. That, I mean, that might be... That might come pretty close to the line, but we'll keep going. We'll find out.
Okay. Chris Sale?
I'm just not sold on Sale.
You're not? No.
Not 100%. And maybe that's my own revisionist history because I don't want him to do it. Yeah. Because the Royals had an opportunity to get him. It's another one where it's very, very close, though.
Okay. Yu Darvish?
I'd probably go with Yu Darvish.
I think I'm with you on that one.
Yeah.
Okay, here's another interesting one. Derek Holland?
Nah, I'd go Shields.
Okay.
Derek Holland, that's an odd guy to jump out there. That must be the old Fangraphs favorability kind of thing.
Yeah.
He's not bad. He's just, you know.
Don't see him that high.
Yeah, we're going on gut, and yeah. I would definitely put Shields over him.
Doug Fister?
I'd go Shields.
Okay. And let's see, David Price.
Ah, the student and the mentor.
The circle is now complete.
I'd probably go with Price, but it's by the thinnest of margins.
Okay.
And you could ask me on another day, and I might go Shields.
Okay. What about John Lester?
I'd go Shields. I'm glad that the trade was for Shields rather than Lester.
Okay.
Because that was the other option to trade Myers.
Okay. Well, so right there, the first names we mentioned going through Doug Fister were the top 12 pitchers by Fangraphs WAR last year, and Shields was the 13th. And then David Price, John Lester were 15 and 16, so they were even below James Shields. But, I mean, let's go back and look at the pitchers that you said that you would take, and I was pretty much in agreement on all of them here, for over James Shields. Clayton Kershaw, Adam Wainwright, Felix Hernandez, Justin Verlander, Cliff Lee, Yu Darvish, and David Price, depending on the day.
So,
out of 14, well, we'll just complete the top 16. What about Matt Latos?
I would go with Shields over Latos.
I think I would too. So, yeah. Out of the top 16, if you take James Shields out and the 15 remaining pitchers, 7 of them we would take over James Shields. Now, if you look at that and you say, okay, out of 30 teams, 7 is roughly, we'll call that 25%, because you still got other pitchers down here too that maybe didn't make it in the top 16 last year. That, I mean, Steven Strasburg and even in the top 30, and you might, I don't know, would you take, that's a good question. Would you take Strasburg over James Shields?
We're talking last game.
Game seven.
Yeah. I might go Shields on that one. Okay. I mean, it's tough to throw Strasburg away, but I mean, it is James Shields, and there is kind of a comfort level that you have to kind of look at too. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, I'd say Shields. That's another one that's very close.
So
I mean, you can kind of see where those tiers kind of blend, you know? So, I mean, you're looking at a guy who's probably could be a top 10, at least top 15 pitcher in the league.
And here's just another tricky one while we're at it. Jose Fernandez.
Not right now, but by the end of the year, I might go Fernandez because he is... He's pretty darn good. And he was good last year.
That's one of those kind of put a pin in it, and we'll talk about this later type.
Right. I mean, in 2 years, he might be the best pitcher in baseball. Right now, he's just kind of knocking on that door. So I could definitely see him being, you know, one of the best.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you look just going from that, you know, the top 15, 16 pitchers in baseball, 7 of them, about 25%. Of the pitchers in the league that you would take over James Shields. Now, the way I like to look at this is you talked about the tier separation. You know, as if anybody who's listened to this show for a long time knows, when I originally came on, I was the football guy. Well, to express this in football terms, you have, when you look at quarterbacks, which are, you know, roughly as the closest equivalent you can have from a football to baseball comparison to an ace pitcher, is if you have a really good quarterback. Now, people always want that franchise quarterback. Well, there's maybe 12 franchise quarterbacks in the NFL, but there's a subset group of that that is in what I like to call the elite quarterbacks, where simply having them on your team nets you 6 wins, you know, and a win in football. I'm not trying to equate that to, you know, 1-4 in baseball. We're not going to get into that kind of a theoretical discussion here.
But that's a whole other thing.
I mean, if you look at Peyton Manning, right, he has not won less than 10 games in his last 10 years as a quarterback, you know, and he's had a lot of churn on the rosters around him, and he's been the one main constant. I mean, there's a reason for that. You know, you look at the Saints and Drew Brees and Aaron Rodgers and the Packers and, of course, Tom Brady and the Patriots. You know, those to me are the four elite quarterbacks in the league that if you have them on your roster, then you're in the playoffs, you've got 10 wins, you can just lock that up, and then the rest is where you can improve by getting the other players around him and so forth. But just that one player can be that important. So when you look at it from a baseball standpoint, okay, Clayton Kershaw, I mean, he's that guy. Every fifth day, you can almost mark it down. I mean, he had 9 losses last year, so I'm not saying he's going to go undefeated or anything, but every fifth day, you can lock it down. Our winning streak, or I mean, if we're ever on a losing streak, it's probably not going to go 5 days because we've got Kershaw we're going to throw out there. If we've got a winning streak, it's probably going to continue whenever past him because, and at the very least, you know, whether you win or lose, you're going to be in that game until Kershaw comes out and then it's up to somebody else. But that's the kind of thing that you can bank on. And with Shields, as we were having this discussion, I kind of thought of the best way to put it might be that James Shields is a pitcher who can pitch at the ace level, but isn't quite that ace. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, is that, you think that's fair, or do you think that's even still a little too much?
Well, yeah, I think that's pretty fair because you'll have players who even the eight, I mean, any guy can get lit up on any given day, but it's limiting the times where that happens. It's also limiting kind of the middling games, you know, where you come out and okay, you only get 5.2 innings and gave up 3 runs and something like that. You know, the ace kind of guys are guys who they might have 2 of those starts, they might have a couple starts where they get, you know, beat up, but most of the time they're going to be, you know, 6-7 innings, if not more. They're going to be, you know, holding guys to 1 or 2 runs or you know, shutting them out, and so they end up, you know, over the course of the year, where even if they have some bad games, because everybody's going to have a bad game, they don't really impact the overall numbers because their other games are so much better. And Shields kind of has more of those kind of middling games. And you saw it last year where kind of in the middle of the year, he kind of swooned a little bit, had a couple of rough games, you know, struggled, but he got it back. And that's another kind of thing to his credit that, you know, he's able to go and kind of get the magic back and get right back to it and finish strong. But, you know, there are periods of time where, you know, he might go out there and just have a lot of average games and one stinker. And, you know, then he can just as easily come across, you know, last year he had, just in September alone, he had 4 games that had 4 starts with a game score of 70 or better. You know, going the James Shields, or not the Bill James. I don't know how you mix those two up, but the Bill James game score kind of thing. You know, where, you know, getting into the 70s is a very, very good game. You know, he had 4 of those, and another one that was a 64 game score. And so, you know, on 5 of his 6 starts were 64 or better. So, you know, he definitely has that run where he can go and just kind of destroy lineups for a long time. If you take out his 1 game against Detroit in September, where he gave up 10 runs on 3.2 innings, an awful game. But you take that out and he only gave up 4 runs otherwise in the other 5 starts. And so that's what you're looking for, a guy who can go on that kind of run even if he has, you know, kind of an iffy game here and there. So, you know, I think he's definitely one of the top guys, but he might be more of a Ben Roethlisberger versus, you know, a Drew Brees, and that's fine. You know, that's a very good player. He's going to help you win a lot of games, and might even get you. You know, Roethlisberger's got what, two rings? Yep. So I mean, it's not like it's
Super Bowl that he lost.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not anything against Roethlisberger to say he's not an elite quarterback, and it's not anything against Shields really to say that he's not an ace, because he's still in the discussion, and that's, you know, just enough. I mean, it's not laughing him out of the building saying he's not an ace.
Yeah, and
because he is.
And basically, the exercise that we went through is we said, oh, you know, there's basically, you know, 7-8 pitchers that we would take over James Shields. But that also, and I'm just talking of the frontline guys from the top 30 there, but there's also, that means roughly 21, 22 that we would take James Shields over. And there are 21 or 22 teams where James Shields would be the number one guy on the squad. Actually, yeah, probably more than that, because if you look at that top 30, some of those pitchers are from the same teams. So, mm-hmm, you know, I mean, so there's probably
like 25 teams would rather have James Shields than whoever leads their staff. And that's pretty
normal. You know, that's not nothing. And right, the point of this exercise is just to kind of say that as good as James Shields is, you know, there are some limitations that he has, and there are, you know, I think people want to go kind of crazy and they want that kind of Zach Greinke type, and they want the Royals to try and re-sign him, and they want him to, you know, be this Kansas City Royals great player pitcher guy. And that's just, it's not what's going to happen, because he's going to try and get ace money, but he's not quite there. And the Royals can't pay ace money. They can't pay not quite there ace money, but even if they could, point is it would be an overpay. You know, and he's going to get overpaid because it's pitching and it's baseball and that's what happens. But it was an interesting point that we had kind of been talking about back and forth, kind of off the air, if you will, and wanted to bring it up on the show. And if you disagree with Mike or I, then go ahead and write us an email, kcbaseballvault@gmail.com. And if you bring up some good points that refute kind of stuff that we've said, then we'll bring it up on air and we'll definitely give you your due and refute the points if necessary, or say, hey, good point. Thanks for bringing that up. But the last thing we want to hit on now, sticking with the pitching, is Danny Duffy as a microcosm of the bullpen. First of all, we talked about Danny Duffy a lot on this show. The guy's been on the show. We're all rooting for him. Everybody in Kansas City, you know, even beyond the show, is rooting for him because we want pitching in this town. We want someone like Danny Duffy, homegrown guy, to succeed. The guy loves the fan base. He wants to be in Kansas City. Had a rough start to the year. Spring training, we documented his difficulties he had there. He got sent to Omaha to start the season. Rocked it down there. Couple of things happened just like we knew they would. We didn't think it might happen this soon. But, you know, we knew Danny Duffy was going to need to be at the beck and call there. And before you know it, a couple weeks into the season, he's back up in the majors. They're using him out of the bullpen because they haven't had a need in the starting than the staff yet. Although, with the way Bruce Chinn's been pitching, I wouldn't be surprised to see him sneak in a start or two, but that's a different conversation. As of now, he has come in and just been lights out of the bullpen. 6.1 innings, and I believe, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Mike, I looked it up earlier and I forgot to keep it up. But 9 strikeouts in 6.1 innings and 2 walks.
So,
and he has not given up a run. 12.7 K per 9, and his walk per 9 is under 3, which is the first time he's had that in his major league career. First time it's been under 5 in his major league career, or under 4, I should say. But, I mean, it's got to be encouraging to you, to all of us, Mike, to have Danny Duffy pitching this well out of the bullpen.
Yeah, even if it's out of the bullpen, which, I'm not sure if ultimately that's where he's going to end up or not. It's at least success. And that was kind of what they talked about early in the year when, you know, there was that point where it was pretty clear that Ventura was going to be getting that last spot in the rotation, you know, pitching lights out, and Duffy wasn't helping himself. And Yost was talking about the possibility of Duffy going to the bullpen. And the explanation was really that they wanted him to come up and have this kind of success where he's getting major league hitters out regularly and able to go out and you know, really show himself just as much as anybody else that he can go do it. And, you know, lo and behold, here it is. There's some injuries, there's some shuffling around, and Duffy ends up coming back onto the big league team, coming out of the bullpen, and, you know, a guy who has thrown longer outings, and so they've used him in a couple of those kind of situations, and he's stepped up. You know, he's throwing 97, 98, and we know he's got the velocity. He's always kind of had that, and really just kind of doing fastball, curveball, you know, as a secondary kind of thing. And so he's able to go out there, and he's having a lot of success so far. I think, you know, he's probably more valuable as a starter just because he can give you more innings that way. But, you know, even in like in Houston, you know, he gave up some hits, but he was able to strike out guys and get out of those kind of situations just with pure gas. And it ended up working out. So I think it's interesting. Like you said, there may be opportunity for Bruce Chen, who's had some glute problems, to, you know, and hasn't pitched well other than his first start. Maybe Duffy would step in for him, and if he did, you know, then you kind of get into a situation where, you know, what do you do? Do you really, you know, the Royals would have to choose, do they want to break up the bullpen as it is now or actually go ahead and try Duffy there? I think if they're going to do it now, you know, or anytime in the very near future, you know, Duffy's got to be the guy, because there's a certain point where he'll be so, you know, used to being in the bullpen that the Royals are not going to want to take him out of there and try him in any other, you know, role, just because he's had that success. And then they don't want to turn around and have him, you know, okay, you know, go ahead and go start, get us at least four innings, and then we'll go from there. I think if he's going to start, they want him in a spot where he can still stretch out and do five or six. And I think he's still kind of at that point, even though, you know, in the last week he's been coming out of the bullpen. But, I mean, you know, if the rest of the rotation holds up and they keep using him out of the bullpen, I guess that's okay for the near future. I do think I'd rather see him in the rotation, but you can't argue with the results either. So it's kind of tough to, you know, have any problem with a 4.5-to-1 strikeout-to-walk ratio and, you know, looking the part as well. I mean, he looks like a big league pitcher. Whereas in other situations, he's looked like, you know, either hesitant or out of his element or overwhelmed or frustrated or anything. You know, he looks confident, and he's throwing that way.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the comparisons that people made with Duffy, if for no other reason than he left baseball for a time and then came back, was Zach Greinke. And if you kind of look, I mean, the parallels seem to continue by, you know, just a force beyond the Royals, where, you know, Zach Greinke left and then he came back and he had his difficulties and the Royals plugged him into the bullpen, and he was kind of a different cat mentally. And, you know, not necessarily that he had, I mean, he did have the documented anxiety disorder, but just from a mental standpoint, not to say anything bad, but he's a different guy. And
he has a different outlook on how he should be doing his job.
Yes. And Danny Duffy, you know, it's not nearly the same extent, but he's a little bit of a different guy. He gets real, real amped up. He gets real, you know, he's really intense. And sometimes that kind of takes some ironing out at the major league level, because you got to know how to be able to handle those emotions. But point being, the similarities there kind of persist. And not only that, but, you know, Zach Greinke, after he came back and he still had some issues, and they put him in the bullpen and he had a lot of success. And then the next year came along and he had a really good year. And then the following year after that, he blew up and in a good way, and
right.
won the Cy Young Award. So not to say that that's what's going to happen with Danny Duffy, but there's definitely, and Greinke's just the pure Royals recent example. I mean, there's a ton historically of pitchers who have maybe had some difficulties, thrown in the bullpen for about a year or so, and then come out and had a long, productive career as a starter. So I agree. I think he's much more valuable to this team as a starter. And one thing that gives me hope that, because my biggest fear when you put a starter in the bullpen, if you're the Royals, is that you just keep him there because, oh man, we've got a player who's good at something. Why do we want to change? You know, that's kind of been the Royals mentality. So if you're Danny Duffy and you're good, that would be my concern. But one thing I think that helps is you've got a lockdown closer, Greg Holland, so they're not going to try and just slowly nudge Danny Duffy into the closer role because you've got an all-star that's already there. And then you've got guys like Wade Davis, guys like Lewis Coleman. You know, you've got a set of relievers that are really, really good that, you know, Kelvin Herrera, guys like that, that you don't have to necessarily – you don't have to make up for as much. And those guys, by the way, have all started pitching better around Duffy. So point being, it's easier for them to say next year, Danny Duffy is going to be in the rotation and you're not going to lose as much from the bullpen, which I think is promising news if you're for Royals fans. And, you know, cause that's one of the things that I've talked about on this show that was really concerning for me was that, if he has success like he has, the Royals are just going to want to stick him there. But I don't think that's what's going to happen this time.
Yeah, and I hope it doesn't because it's, you know, it would be very, very easy for them to do that. And I hope it doesn't go that route. I mean, right now he's throwing like two-thirds of his pitches for strikes. And, you know, that's pretty good. I mean, usually we'll see him kind of half and half. I don't have the exact numbers. And in fact, I'm trying to find that right now, but you know, I mean, he's doing a good job right there when he comes in, and he comes in and you know, is throwing fire, not to steal the phrase from Yordano Ventura, but yeah, Greinke's a good example because Greinke was a guy who was, you know, he wanted to work on his changeup and he liked to throw that Ephus pitch, and he was trying to get by throwing like 88, 89 miles an hour, and they put him into the bullpen when he was coming back in 07 and just asked him to air it out and just, you know, bring the gas, and he did it, and he was hitting like 97. And you know, when he transitioned towards the end of that year back into the rotation and in 2008, you really saw results from it. You know, it's almost like he had to remember how to throw fire. Another weird example is Rick Wild Thing Vaughn.
Hey-o.
From sure. Major League. Exact same thing, art imitating life and life imitating art or whatever. Not that that's, you know, valid, but, you know, I mean, there's a reason they chose that kind of idea. You know, he was the guy who's, I'm going to talk too much about Major League 2 now, but, you know, where he's throwing like 88 miles an hour because he wants to, you know, finesse it. He wants to do this. And it's not until he goes and, you know, realizes, okay, I'm a hard thrower. This is what I need to do. That he kind of realizes, you know, everything at the end. And he gets the girl, too. So
yeah.
I'm guessing, you know, Greinke's got the girl and Duffy should probably get the girl, too.
And that's another thing that we need to get Scobes back on here and talk about this fallacy that has been perpetuated by a lot of people in Major League Baseball that you can't throw hard if you're a starting pitcher. You know, I mean, it's that mentality that turned Yordano Ventura from a starting pitching prospect into a bullpen prospect until he started proving everybody wrong and saying, hey, I can pitch like I'm pitching at 100 miles an hour, and I can go 6, 7, 8 innings, and I can pitch 200 innings a year. And he hasn't done it yet, but he continued to increase his innings load to the point where you think it's definitely not only a possibility, but a probability. So, you know, I think there's a lot of confusion between throwing hard and throwing with a lot of effort. You know, I think there are a lot of people out there that will throw 89 miles an hour with a lot of effort, and it probably doesn't look good, and it's probably puts them at greater risk for Tommy John, you know. So, but there's somebody like Yordano Ventura who just looks effortless, and he throws 97, 98. And point being, to your Grinke point, where he's just trying to finesse and throwing, you know, in the high 80s and all that, and not having much success. I mean, they're, you know, sometimes it takes a little bit to click, and sometimes it takes an organization to say, you know, just kind of get out of his way. You know, and the Royals have had a hard time doing that with people in the past. So hopefully this is a thing where, you know, whatever Duffy does to have success, the Royals will see it in the bullpen and they'll say, hey, you know, just do it. Whatever you did then, just keep doing it now, and we'll ride you as long as we can. So I don't know. I mean, and just, we've kind of gone long here, so we'll start to wrap this up. But, you know, on top of Duffy, we've had the whole bullpen is just, after a slow start for the first week or so, they've really come on strong lately, and they've put themselves in some position. The Royals have put them in some positions where they needed to play big, and they've come in and played big. And you got to be happy with where the bullpen's at now.
Yeah, I mean, it looked like that was, you know, we knew before the season that was a likely strength. And then through the first couple games, you know, they just weren't. I mean, Tim Collins wasn't doing well, and it seems he was, you know, headed for the DL. And, you know, Wade Davis was having some struggles, and even Greg Holland was having some problems. Herrera, you know, everybody was having some issue. And they've all kind of calmed down as they've gotten more work. They've been able to go out there and actually, you know, build up some innings. And I think that's what you would see, is you should expect that from these guys who, you know, are top-notch pin arms, guys who will go out there and, you know, even if they're going to get five outings, you know, that's five innings. Four out of those five are going to be pretty good. Maybe that one's not good, but, you know, some of them can limit the damage. Greg Holland's a good example of that. You know, so that over time, as they build up those innings, you know, they're going to be a lot closer to what you expect. And in fact, you know, Greg Holland, according to Fangraphs, is the highest WAR pitcher on the Royals staff. So, and Wade Davis is fifth. So, I mean, that's what you're looking at. I mean, those are guys who are coming in and they're doing their job. And even though, you know, Davis walked a lot of guys early and Holland was giving up a few hits, they were still, you know, doing, you know, over time. It's the whole thing. Baseball is such a slow game, and it's, you know, if you're looking at stats, it's a slow accumulation. You know, some early struggles can really show up as a lot bigger problems than they actually turn out to be. And so, you know, they've kind of righted the ship in that sense. And it's good to see, because they really needed them in a few of those games. I think they went like 20 innings without giving up a run. And even the guys who gave up runs were, you know, Justin Marks, Michael Marriott, guys that you're not really relying on. They were just kind of coming in to, you know, take up the innings so that, you know, you can save the other guys. So I think we can call off the warning on those guys for now.
Yes, it's been downgraded.
Yeah.
Down to DEFCON 2 now.
Code level yellow? I don't know.
Yeah, that sounds right.
I don't know.
And on that note, I think we'll leave you tonight or today or this morning or whenever you're listening to this through the magic of podcasting and smartphones and all that and computers. But yeah, so we, you know, the Royals, if you're probably listening after Monday, obviously, and the Royals have lost, so they're down to 9-9, and they're a couple games back of the Tigers now, but still in the thick of the race after call off the dogs, if you will. The Royals are still, they've been able to bounce back, and they're still in this. So we're definitely it's got a long season. We got a lot of stuff to talk about. And if you have anything that you want us to talk about on the show, any ideas, or you want to tell Mike and I how big of idiots we are, you won't be the first, probably not the last, but please email baseballvault@gmail.com. And I am Jeff Herr. This is Mike Engel. As always, we are the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. If you have you guys want to have a good time, go on down to Kelly's, visit them, go talk to Chris, the bartender, tell him we sent you. He probably will do nothing except say thanks for listening and thanks for coming in. But you should definitely go down to Kelly's, because it's an awesome time regardless. Thanks again for listening, and for Michael Engel and the absent Troy Olsen, I am Jeff Herr, and as always, go Royals.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.